Accession number 14975, William Rochester, reel 20.
Mr. Rochester, reel 20. Geographically, Mr. Rochester, where were you in relation to the village of Roray in the position that you held?
We were on the east side of Roray. We'd come from the north, and we were facing west when we got there. The enemy were on the west, and we were in the orchard facing west, then settled in there. And on the south side of us, there was of the orchard was open country, like wheat fields. And there'd obviously been the troops in front of us had been there as well, because there was numerous slit trenches dug in the corner of the field, and you could have your choice. And I had a section over there because it was wide open space. The crop was very low, actually. It was only about a foot high. So we had good view of the open space over there in that side. And this is where the couple of young officers said they would rather go there than sit in the orchard and with a telephone and things like that, because we had a telephone there to carry on, and for me to carry on as a sergeant major. And luckily, I went into the right slip, the first one, and the other one went off. But the second one, I just took him so far over, and he was there a day and a half or 2 days, when he was out walking around and went back into the, and he hit slit for the shell, the same as the other one did. It was just damned unlucky, that's all. I mean, you could never guarantee putting a shell or a mortar bomb or anything like that in a slit trench. I mean, we were all told, as long as we dug 6 inches and lay flat on our stomachs, it would only be our equipment that got hit. You know, it would just go across the top and miss it. And this is what we did. The kids used to have a bit of fun and games when they wanted to go to the toilet. You know, how deep do I dig this, sir?
You had a very young company, you referred to them as kids.
Yeah.
How were they standing up to this? They were very young.
They were terrific. They had more energy than any of the other ones put together. I mean, they weren't trained. They hadn't been trained as long as the majority of them. Some of the lads they were called up people, but they'd been in a year and a half, and 2 years. Some of them, and all that time they'd been training. These kids had come in fairly quickly. If they'd been in 6 months, it was lucky. But they obeyed your orders, they did what you wanted, and sometimes they did things without it being told to do them and come back and report. They were very, very good. I had one kid, I can't remember his name. Ina knows his name because she read about it. He was fully 18, just on the 18 mark. And he used to disappear every now and then out of the orchard. One of the kids would come up and say, yes, I'm be some of them section commanders, you know, you look after that group, you look after that group. And no paper, no names, I didn't even have a pencil. But that's your section, you know, that's your, look after them. And every other day they'll come up, and his name will come in a minute. He's missing the gear, sir. A little bugger. Well, then he would turn up. He'd be missing hours or a day or a night. Then turn up the next day, and then his section commander would bring him along. He said, you see, he's got another niche on his... He used to put a niche on his gun shaft. On his gun shaft. And I said, what's... And he was like that, you know. He was a funny... He was restless. He wanted to do something all the time. Well, the orchard... At the very most was about 60, 70 yards along the front, the Y, and it was about 50 yards there, like a rectangle. And we were facing on the long side with a building at the end, an old wooden building at the end. He came up to me one night. He came up and he said, we've got some visitors down there, sir. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, they've carried a machine gun down there. I said, oh, what gun? He said, it's like one of our machine guns, it's on legs. It's an automatic gun and it's on legs. It's got a tunnel, a round barrel and all that. I said, which way is it pointing? He said, along that way. They're going to point fire along that way. Well, there's another company on our right-hand side. They weren't firing at us. They were only about 30 yards from our hedgerow. So I went down and had a look. I took my glasses down to have a look where you didn't need them. They're about 30 yards in the hedgerow. The hedgerow from the side of this track road, you see. He said, if you give me permission, I'll shift them for you. I said, oh, yes. And what are you going to do? He said, I just want a big automatic gun, that's all. So we come away, and we watched them a bit. They were setting this machine gun down. It was a heavy, pretty heavy one. It carried it in. And it very much like the old-fashioned machine gun, you know, with the legs and that. I don't know what kind of it was or anything. But he said, we'll shift them. We had a paired gun that we'd hit the tanks with before. We still had that. We eventually got that back and a few bombs. So he wanted that. So we took it down for him. And he said, can I fire it? I said, sure. I said, but it's going to be get dark very soon, you know, and you'll not be able to see anything. Wait till they fire the gun. And then aim for the weather where you see the stuff, the smoke and that coming out there. Go back about a yard. Just move your gun a fraction to what you think is about a yard, that distance, and then fire. Oh, he said, right, I'll try that. He said, mind, I want to fire one or two. So we got another kid there and myself, and he was behind his gun, and he rattled it off. He said, I'm going to fire now, you know. He rattled it off, and then dropped another one in. Then we went up and had a look. Oh, what a mess. He'd hit the gun, smashed the gun, hit the gun with the first one. And then he hits them. There were three bodies. What we could make out, there was three personnel with their all dead, and that machine gun. And they were firing across to where A Company was, and the flank. They were firing flankwise across onto them. You see,
they hadn't realised you were that close.
No, they mustn't have. They were silly if they'd known we were there, but they couldn't see us because the way their fields are. You know, they go terrifically high. And we can walk across the field here, and you kind of see us from the hedgerow. Never mind about being in the ditch. You walk up and down on the top, and they couldn't see you because it was at least 4 or 5 feet high. Then the hedgerow on top of that, you see, right down. You mustn't have seen us at all. But this little twerp, Stansfield, that's his name, little Stansfield, niches on his... and missing again, Stansfield missing again.
So he was out hunting. He went out hunting them, presumably.
He went looking for something anyhow, and you couldn't stop him. He was an innocent little flirt, you know. I used to bawl him out like, and he just used to stand and look at me. Sorry, sir, I'll not do it again anymore today. And that's what he used to always put the deer in. He'd give him a lease for the next day, you know. He's the man that he disappeared one day, and the lad reported him. Stansfield's off again. I said, all right. And later on in the afternoon, another kid come across to me and said, there's some Germans coming down, we can see them. They'd been standing on the field and the foot dug into the side, looking through the bottom of the trees, and they'd seen German hats and rifles with bayonets on coming down the hedgerow, down the bottom. And he said, so I got up and had a look. I said, hey, there's about eight or nine of them coming down there. Right. So I said, come on, round here. So we bought four machine guns facing the door down here, and there was a big five-bar gate here that come into the fence, and another one along this side where you catch them, you know, if they come in. But they were coming down this road. So we had four machine guns facing that road for when they come down. And I said, now, I'll fire first. Nobody fires till I shout. I'll fire first, and you will let off after that. Let them come down so we can see who they are. They came down there. We're sitting there, all edged up. First one to come round the corner was Stansfield. 5'2" in height, with a rifle slung on his shoulder, marching. And 10 bloody big, 5'10" Germans walking behind him. Following behind him. Oh, God. I said, what the devil? What's the matter? Oh, man, he said, they're finished. They didn't want to fight anymore. They're fed up. They're hungry. They don't want to fight. So... We brought them in, sat them down, And one or two of them could speak quite a good bit of English. The other one could just a few words, like, you know. So he said, I said, what are you doing here? He said, we're finished. We've packed it in. We've had enough of this. It's ridiculous. Finished. These are my words, you know. They just want to pack in. I said, well, we'll have to send you down to headquarters. And Stansfield put it in. He said, come on, I'll give them a fag and something to eat. They got some biscuits or something to eat. So we had our little box, a tin box that we got grub in that lasted you a fortnight, little cubes. Did you know about them? I'll tell you. It's like a box of chocolates, about so big, like that, about that deep. And everything was like cubed. You got a black and white cube, which was a cup of tea with milk and sugar in. You just dropped and put some hot water in. You had a little fuel, formless fuel or something, you know. No smoke from it. You dug a hole in the side of your slit, put a bit of water in, set fire to this thing underneath. You boil your water, and you can have a nice cup of tea. You can have chocolate. You had to break it with a rifle or something like that. You couldn't bite. You had to suck it. You couldn't bite it. You had to break it with your bayonet and that, put it in your mouth, and you just kept it in there and sucked it all the time till like halfway gone, and it got soft. You could chew it after that. And you could live on them. There was potatoes, little cubes of potatoes in, and bits of vegetable and that. Everything was mixed up, you know, and you got a feed to it. Till this was to keep you going. Well, our quartermaster used to come up, Jimmy. He was right up. He was in trouble for bringing his truck right up to the front line. He had to stop about 100 yards away back, or supposed to be, and we had to go down by sections, you know, and get the tins and bring the stuff up. But we had some of the lads had some of these left behind, and we fed them, give them something to eat, and that. And they were very, very interested in the self-heating soup. There was a couple of tins of that left, so we shared that out with them, you know. Pulled the cap off and struck it, and it smoked like mad. Then you got to drink a hot soup.
Did you find out which regiment or unit they belonged to, these Germans?
No, we didn't actually. I wanted to get rid of them. I was pleased to get rid of them, actually.
Were the Panzermen or infantry or what?
I think they were infantry. There was Panzer over there because there'd been a big battle in front of us, but these would be the infantry that was following the Panzer fellas up, you know. And
Were they arrogant or
no?
Quiet?
No. They were quite kindly. They were just like I'm talking to you. And we asked them why they'd done it, and they said we're finished. We're beaten. It's no good there. We're going to shoot somebody and they're going to shoot us, so we might as well pack it up and finish. Everybody else has gone and left us, and we're finished.
What happened to Stansfield? And did he
was there when I left. Oh, he was still there when I left. I don't know. I tried to get hold of him once before, and another lad called Johnny, he lived in Het, or the west side of Newcastle. Up there, and he followed me around in about three or four battalions. I don't know how he did it live, but he followed me around. He used to look after me like a son. He was smashing. He made stuff like this. He made my son a chair from the railings when we're in England. He got some railings somewhere, I made that, then he wanted padding. I don't know where he got the padding from, but the cover stuff. It was the company commander's table cover. We whipped that and made a little chair for my son.
Was there any sign of stress or breakdown amongst your group? I mean, you were there a few days, weren't you?
Yes.
Under fire.
We were there probably about 5 days, 4 or 5 days. It started on the...
Was there any signs of...
No. I didn't feel any at all, because it wasn't prolonged. It was something that happened. And then it stopped, you know. They're trying to break through. You'd get four or five people. Somebody would spot one or two people coming down through the hedgerows. Couple of hedgerows that went at right angle, straight away from us. That way, our hedgerow was like that. And there was a couple went that way. They were coming down there.
Right angle, like a three-sided,
yeah, like a T junction, you know. And the ground had a little bump in it, so they could come so far. For all the corn in that part, was higher than on the outside of the orchard. Why, I don't know. I never bothered to think of it, but it just dawned on me that it was because they were coming through on hands and knees through the corn this way when they were coming. And I think so. The first one that ever came through that way, I think he must have fired his rifle accidentally as he was putting his rifle forward. He'd had his hand on the trigger and fired. That warned us all. So after that, we always had, we always had somebody watching. But was it really was meant watching after that, you see. And we knocked quite a few off coming through. They tried to infiltrate through to get through us, both on the flanks and coming straight at us as well. We lost a few kids there. Well, they were wounded. I don't know. I think some of them were badly wounded as well. But they could have progressed. I don't know. But they got back. That's why we went down to about to 30. Because they weren't all killed. There were these fellas showing the Royal Rifle. A lot of them had rifle injuries on them when we threw there.
What rifle injuries? What do you mean?
Well, wounded with a rifle. Yeah, and if you got a mortar bomb or an artillery shell dropping among you, anybody anywhere near there was finished, and you couldn't find them. But with a rifle, it's just one or two. If it's an automatic rifle, you get two or three in the same place, more or less.
You know. Is a clump of trees, an orchard, or whatever it is, more of a target for enemy gunfire than open space? I mean, is it more dangerous to be in the orchard or than outside in open space? Does it attract enemy gunfire?
Well, it will. It would attract us for gunfire, particularly if there's anything comes from it. We had the orchard in a square, you know, in a rectangle like this, and there was a hedgerow went up there. It went up about 150 yards, then stopped. Then there was cornfield, the whole cornfield spread there. Well, this hedgerow separated for about 150 yards, with a 5-bar gate here, and about 60, 70 yards that way. Then there was a big copse that went up, and it curled round for about what? Quarter of a mile at the far end, and then it stopped. It went there. Now, from that corner of that copse, we could see across the field quite comfortably. And every now and then, there was firing, automatic fire, and it was coming through our trees. We could hear them whistling through the tops of the trees, you see. And I thought, well, that's funny. We had an artillery bloke up with us, by the way.
This is the story that you've got where you turned the artillery man turned the fire, and it was your own side. Yeah.
Well, we had an artillery man up there, and I thought that there was a German detachment there, and these were the rifles. These were the ammunition coming up from automatics. But what it was afterwards, we found out, was part of the tank battle, which was a bit further over. There was a crest, a bit further over the crest, and these were the ammunition from the German tanks that was coming through the tops of our trees, and that was the platoon of the Hallamshire Regiment up there. But they were using German weapons, you see. So, if you see any closed part, any part where you could hide in, and noise come from there, ammunition noise come there, you shelled it as soon as you could, if you could. This is why we had the artilleryman put some shells. Well, he said he put them on himself straight away. He was in touch with the artillery. We couldn't do that. We could just tell our people and let them do it. We were fortunate. We had a telephone there. Why it lasted so long, I don't know. It was still there when I come over here. But it was run out. The telephonist had run it out for us.
Were you putting patrols out at night? When you were there?
No, but we after this business with that win on the left, the gun on the left, you know, where Stansfield knocked off, we had three men up there. That was only about 100 yards up there. They'd go so far up there, individually, and you know, spice away up there. And A Company on the other side. They joined up with me, going up in the edge of this wood that went round. They were behind the wood at the bottom, it went round there. We had lookouts, and you only had 50% sleeping. while the others were watching. It took me to take turns on that.
How free could you move during daytime, for example?
Quite free.
You could move properly. Well.
If you move properly.
Which was?
Going through the trees. I mean, we had a gap like this, 5-bar gate. This is the orchard here. Orchard here and orchard. If I come along here and I wanted to go to there, I walk through the trees.
Rather than go across the gap of the gate.
That's right. I had a machine gun there at the corner, and I had a machine gun at this side. The Bren, automatic. No, that's all we have. There. We had a person came up, that's all I'm going to say. And he walked up, and he would stand in the middle here and try to give orders out. And eventually I got him away from the place. And I don't want to say any more about it.
Was this an officer?
He was one of the people that came up to take over. And he wanted to look round, you see. So we got to there, and I went round this way, and he's standing in the middle of the open space down here. And I shouted at him, I said, get out the road, come this way. And one of my kids went up to him and got hold of his hand and said, the Sergeant Major wants you over here, and pulled him across. Pulled him back behind the hedgerow, you see.
Was he in a bad state? Was he beginning to crack? Or stress getting to him?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was anything like that at all. Eventually he got wounded by walking across there. I mean, you got two trees down. Well, you had to go at least 4 or 5 trees. You know, whichever line you look, whichever way you look, the trees are all in line. And Bill walked round the trees to come here. So did everybody else. All the kids and that did as well. They were sensible. And this one never crossed over to here. He was behind the trees. He had his gun ready to fire, basically through, partly up with the bank, you see, through there.
For your meals over the 5 days that you were there, were these only coming up at night, and did you have to make do with what you had during the day?
Yeah, they were coming up. The heavy meal came up around tea times, 5-ish, 4-ish, 5-ish, something like that, before it got dark. They were coming up there. It was still fairly light because it was June, you know. About 5, anywhere around 5 or 6, he would come up with a meal. And he'd also leave stuff for us to keep us going the following day. And chicken was pretty good. There was plenty of chicken, hens floating around and that, you know. And they were gorgeous. You just coated them, you killed them, knocked their heads off, killed them, covered them with clay, you know, soft clay, covered them all over with soft clay. You had a petrol tin with some soil in, put some petrol in it, set fire to it, and put the chicken on the top. And it cooked itself, you know, it got cooked in there. When you took the top off, all the feathers and the skin come off with it, and it was lovely. that was something we found out there. Well, one of the lads did it. He said he'd read about it somewhere, and he said, you know, I'm going to try it. If I didn't mind, could he try it? I said, sure. There's nobody there to stop them. The hens were floating around. And one fellow wanted to cut some out. There was quite a few cows who were lying with the legs up, you know. And terrific size, you know, the gas fills them all out. They're really massive. And they wanted to know why they were doing that. And one lad said, the thing to do is to stick a bayonet in them and they'll go down. I said, don't do that round here, son. If you're going to stick a bayonet in one, get away over there where that house is. Find the one over there and stick it in over there, but don't do it here. Why? I said, you'll find out when you do that, but don't touch them here. Leave them the way they are. And we were lucky, you know, there's none of them lying in the orchard that would ever hit. But he wanted to know what had happened. We sent him on patrol around the orchard in touch with the patrol from the other side. You know, they used to go around the field. And he stuck his bayonet in there. He stung for 2 days. It's a terrible smell when it comes out.
What orders were you receiving during your stay there? Were you getting orders from your commanding officer?
Not
or was
a
it
lot.
Left to yourself?
Not a lot. We were left there. He knew we were there. We said we were all right. He came up to see us, and he knew we were all right there. And He just said, anything we wanted, get in touch. Well, the quartermaster, the colour sergeant, was up sometimes twice a day because he didn't have any regulations, Jimmy.
This is, what was his name?
Colour sergeant Jimmy, yeah. Oh, they come back. He lives up the Reckendon. He did, like, he lives in London now. He married a girl from London, and he talks a toffee in his mouth, you know. He's a canny lad, though. He's quite good to us. He was quite good there. I don't know if I've told you once over there, the kids brought a cow in that was in agony, wanted milking. Dreadful. And nobody knew how to milk it. There was only 40 of us, about, you know, and none of them had been on a farm. God, I said, I'm the only one that's worked on a farm and ever done anything like this, so I'll have to have a go. So they got the cow down into this ditch, you know, that where the field was a 3-foot ditch, and all that soil goes on the top there, and then same on the other side, so you're way up here, and you're level at this side. They got the cow down into there, and Joe Soap got underneath it with a half a petrol tin on my chest, and I was milking. Then they started motoring, and the motor came over and sliced the cow head and back, you know, at the top, and fell on me. Well, every sodden one of them had to be brought along to have a look at the Sergeant Major covered with a cow before they'd get me out. I couldn't move. They just flopped on me, you know, and of course I was blood all over the place. And I was like that when I ruined it afterwards. The sods.
You seem to have had a somewhat closer relationship with these young men than most sergeant majors with their platoons or companies.
Well,
an affection almost for
it's
them.
It's just the way you treat them, and if you treat them as human beings, they treat you as a human being. I mean, there's no. You see a film on there. You see a sergeant or a corporal yelling his flaming head out with his nose to nose to somebody he's talking to. Well, that's just damn ridiculous. You don't get anything for that. He doesn't know what you're saying. You're shouting too much to him. It's not even going in. I learnt this when I was a youngster. I was trained up by people from the First World War. When I went to India, the 3 or 4 of the sergeants were all ex-First World War people, and they used to talk to you and training and tell you things on training, how to do this and how to do that. If you've got to give an order, make sure everybody knows it, even if you've got to say it 3 or 4 times, go to 3 or 4 different places. If you've got a group of people, you can't just shout there, because they're the only ones, and outside noises, you might as well go closer to them and talk to them. And things like that pay. If somebody does something stupid, you don't go up to him and give him a good bollocking while his pals are there. You just say, I want to see you later, you know, and then half an hour. I'll see you down at my place half an hour. I've got a job for you. Anything to take the minds of the other ones that I wasn't going to give him a rollicking. I had something to do, you know, I've got a job for him. I want you to do something for me or something like that. Then when I got him by himself, I could tell him then what he'd done wrong. Ask him why he did it and all this, that and the other. Did he realise that it was wrong? You'll not do it again because it's silly and stuffy and it affects everybody. And because you take him away and talk like that, they appreciate you more and they'll come to you after that. It's only common sense.
At this stage, how many of your young men had you lost?
Well, I would think probably half of them. We had about 40 to start with. There's roughly around about 40 we had in England before we left. And the last count I had, we had 30 bodies. And I think there was about 12 to 14 of the young ones left there. But there weren't young ones then. They were as good as anybody else. They're as good as anybody. I was in Thetford when we got to know that they were going with us. They were called immatures. At 40-something, 45, 46-something, immatures in the company, plus the rubbish that the other companies didn't want. Well, I had to get to know them, and I had about a month to get to know them, get them trained, to realise it. And because I didn't yell and shout at them, I think that's part of the trouble. That was part of getting to know them. I went and talked to them rather than bawl my head off at them, you know. If they did something wrong, I would show them how to do it myself. And if they had to strip the Bren guns blindfolded, I would strip mine and put it back. I would strip it, put the stuff down, and I'd say, now move it around, but just keep it within, so I can in touch, in reel it. But move it where you like. Because when I stripped it, I put it all in a heap. And they would shift it all around. But you had to feel by your hand where it went, where it was. You didn't want it. You got something else to do that. Because I was doing it as well as them and making a ghoulies of it, you know. Putting the wrong one in or trying to. They got to know you.